Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show
on the Athletic Podcast Network. Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
not talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Try all you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Everybody, we don't know how to tamper with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast. I'm Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic. Here as always, we got Fred Katz, we got Anthony Slater, we got playoff basketball, we got cracking voices. Good morning to you. What's up, boys?
Oh, Fred's covering a Western Conference team from the East Coast. He's got these
I don't know how to describe you
how
anymore,
is life,
Fred?
I'm always tired, so it's fine. You fight through the tiredness and then you sleep in August. That's how being an NBA reporter works. So I'm good.
All right, Slater. Energy dip already happening. Fred's coming with the I've been up till 4 a.m. writing Grizzly remotely.
No, I am coming in with I am sprightly. I am energized. If you never sleep, then you force yourself to constantly energize and you forget everything you've done in the last 7 minutes. But you know what? You're awake.
What do you got, Slater? What's your vibe?
I'm good. We still have 7 of the 8 first round playoff series are alive. Only one sweep, and it wasn't an uninteresting
sweep. Man, who could that be?
Sweep,
who would you guess would be the first team to bow out of the NBA playoffs? If I asked you back in October, who would be the first team to bow out of the NBA playoffs? Who would come to mind? Serious question. Who? Just pick a team. Who would you have thought?
I would have said the Portland Trailblazers.
All right, fair. History would you know, look kindly on that prediction.
They would love that result also.
Yeah, exactly. You know who would love the Sacramento Kings? They would love that.
Oh,
result.
We needed to get a Kings dig in within the first
Fred,
2 minutes.
You know,
unbelievable.
You're kind of East Coast and West Coast now. Who would you think at season's beginning, as we're about to talk about the Brooklyn Nets?
I think I was pushing the Hornets for the 8th seed.
Okay.
Preseason in the East. So I think probably the Hornets. They, you know, I figured they'd get there and be a fun team and then be young and inexperienced and you know, get killed by a number one seed in the first round, like maybe Brooklyn.
Yeah, like the Nets, right? The powerhouse.
Right. So what you both are underscoring, right, is that first round bowouts are typically reserved for teams that can say, good job, good effort, and we were happy to be here and we were not favored. But man, these Nets, they come in obviously not favored because of their ridiculous regular season roller coaster and everything that came into it. But I'm pretty stunned, and we're going to get around to all the series today. Fred is on Grizzlies Timberwolves, which has been a lot of fun and been enjoying Fred's coverage. A little change of pace for him. Slater obviously is on Warriors Nuggets that got somewhat surprisingly extended, but we start today with Nets Celtics. This series, I mean, for me, is like the most entertaining sweep in recent memory, for sure, because sweeps are typically boring. But to watch, you know, these two squads, both wildly talented, both mostly healthy. Robert Williams in the beginning of the series wasn't available. He was there at the end. But pretty stunned for me to see, you know, this cast of characters on the Brooklyn side and obviously Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, chief among them, go down like this. I mean, Kevin ends up having a good game 4, did figure a few things out offensively after a brutal first 3 games in this series. You know, Kyrie sputters at the end. They had plenty of offense. They couldn't stop anybody, and Boston survives after Tatum fouled out late. But guys, I mean, not only do the Celtics look, you know, very, very capable of winning the entire thing, you know, they just bounced a couple of Hall of Famers who had championship aspirations in mind.
I was convinced earlier in the series that the Tatum game winner in game 1, which, you know, split second, let's just say either he misses it or just doesn't get it off in time. I was convinced like that was the swing game. Whoever won that was going to win the series. And the fact that Boston did, they should be able to survive in six or seven. I'm no longer convinced that that swung the series. Like if Brooklyn wins that game, I think Boston's still winning in five or six. Just they were just clearly the better team. And to me, you know, I'm sure we will get into like the Nets side of this and the aftermath, the obituary essentially of their odd season. But generally, I think takeaway number one is like, Boston was just dominant and looks dominant and to me looks like the East favorite at this point. Just the way they just bottled them up defensively and still look dangerous offensively. And Jason Tatum looked like a legit top five, top 10 player in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a vote this year, but he would have been on my first team All-NBA. Like, I think Jason Tatum is, you know how we always say there are more than five top five players? I think Jason Tatum is
That's
one of those.
That's not how first team All-NBA works, Fred.
I think Jason Tatum is one. He's in that conversation. I agree with you. He's become such an unbelievable player, and especially over these last 3.5 months, when the Celtics have totally ratcheted up, it's unbelievable. I know that the Nets, from a overall big picture perspective, are the bigger story, but just in terms of the basketball. The Celtics were insane in this series. And by the way, Sam, part of the reason why it was such an entertaining sweep was that all the games were actually close. And the way that, I mean, I think it was a total of 18-point differential between the two teams in a four-game sweep, which is really damn close for a sweep. And to see the way the Celtics defense would ratchet up really throughout the series, but especially in those final 5 minutes of fourth quarters, it's just insane. And the big difference was just you see like Jason Tatum hit an open pull up and you just think like you see Jaylen Brown get to the rim with a little more ease. And you just think like those are not the types of looks that Brooklyn is able to get. And those aren't the types of looks you're able to get against Boston's defense. I just think that is the most insane. I think this is one of the best defenses for any NBA team in years. I think we have to go back a long way to find a better defense. They're outrageous defensively from personnel perspective, from a scheme perspective, from buy-in perspective. It's just crazy.
So I wish I had that historical context in front of me. I saw some stuff yesterday on social media indicating that historically they're not on anybody's short list. But in the here and the now, I'm 100% with you. And I wonder how much of it too is how compatible they are just for today's game. I mean, that's obviously the major thing here is how switchable they are, how long they are. I had a lot of fun over the weekend writing that piece about with two different scouts anonymously weighing in on the Celtics and Kevin Durant. And my takeaway there was one of them described the Celtics as monsters and he just went through their lineup. And he even texted me after the story came out. He's like, oh, I forgot about Grant Williams. Like he's a monster too. Like they're all not only long, not only sound and defensively capable, but they are strong as hell. And even mentioned like Tatum and Jaylen Brown, he's like, these guys a couple years ago were getting pushed around. And, he said Tatum is a big mother effer and Brown too. And you saw that. I mean, Slater, if you go back to this series for me, had me in my head going down memory lane with Kevin Durant and a lot of the Oklahoma City playoff experiences back in the day when we knew how transcendent he was. Nobody was questioning that. But, on the playoff stage, he would, be such a focal point of the opposing defense that he would look frustrated at times and he would have, good games and bad games and be inconsistent and just getting, teams getting under his skin. The Spurs did it back in the day. The Grizzlies did it back in the day. There was a ton of that here. And it was not a terrible series for him. Again, good game four, but a terrible series.
I covered 7 Kevin Durant seasons, and I never remember him getting his shot blocked in isolation like Tatum did. I think it was game 2 or 3. Did you guys remember that? When
he
was like a pullback.
I think he
jumper.
Did it back
Tatum
to back games, didn't he?
Straight in front of him, lefty just swatted his jumper.
Yeah,
I was like, what?
Yeah,
like, that doesn't happen. But Grant Williams almost reminded me of PJ Tucker last season. Remember when PJ Tucker was on the Bucks and the way it was just like big bully, get under him. And that's the thing with Durant. That's all, the talent's always been immense, but he's not a great screener. It's one of his few flaws because he just doesn't love to just like, get super physical, even offensively. And then, on the other end, He doesn't love going against smaller guys that can get under him and really kind of push his legs, his core, his thighs. And to me, that's what Grant Williams kind of did. And I thought it was a good tag team. Marcus Smart, another guy. I mean, you even saw it last night, the way Smart's, you know, trying to tip his dribble away and then dive in almost in like a dangerous, you know, he always borders on a little dangerous. It's what got Steph Curry hurt, honestly.
Right, right, right.
So that's just, gosh, you could tell it was physically wearing and mentally wearing on Durant to face all that physicality and different types of defenders. And then I think by games 2-3, particularly once they got back to Brooklyn, I think there was a sense from KD that like they weren't going to win the series. And I think once he got that feeling, it's like you have less motivation to really try to muscle up with these guys.
Fred, yes, later, remember in the 2014 playoffs when second round series against the Clippers, when they put Chris Paul on him for the fourth quarter, and he was just so annoyed trying to post up Chris Paul in the high post with all those double teams. And that's like the ultimate small guy on Kevin Durant moment.
It is. What's interesting about that, though, is
lucky that he avoided Jose Alvarado. Is that what you're saying, Fred?
Typically, particularly yes, since exactly. Durant has entered like mid prime, it's like people remember that Chris Paul because like it was like a fourth quarter where he kind of like, you know, bothered KD and got a win. But then it was like 41 the next game from Durant. Or Patrick Beverley a few years ago when KD was on the Warriors, like there was one game where Patrick Beverley kind of got into him a little bit. They ended up getting double tees. I think KD got tossed. Then he has the quote, the memorable soundbite of like, I'm Kevin Durant, you know who I am. And then he goes like 50, 45, 50, essentially his next few games. Like usually he solves that. He did not solve Boston.
Well, part of the thing with Boston, which I think is, look, it's a lot easier said than done to compile a team like this. But one thing that Brad Stevens, the general manager, has done very well and identified very well building this roster is what does every single late game situation turn into in the playoffs? It just tends to be, all right, we have now identified who the weak link is against our offense and against our players, and we are going to constantly screen that guy until we can get the weak link guarding our best player, and then our best player is going to destroy that weak link. And that is what happens time and time again, late in games in the playoffs, over and over. Now, I think Boston has maybe their best trait beyond the fact they have the defensive player of the year in Marcus Smart, and they have a guy who I think should be on all defense and Robert Williams III, and just all of these excellent experienced defenders around them, is that they don't have the weak link. Like when you're out there, like you can try to hunt Derek White, but good luck. Derek right. White's really good. Right. You can try to go at Al Horford because you think he's not as good as he used to be, but you'd be wrong. He's exactly. really good.
He might be better.
He is really, really, like, he is a really good defender, and you just go around, and it's like, okay, fine. Try to get a switch. Like, the defense is proactively switching because, like, okay, yeah, sure, go at excellent Jason Tatum. Go at excellent Jaylen Brown. There really isn't that much of a weak link, and if you want to, if Daniel Tice becomes exploitable because they figure out something with Tice, who, by the way, is like a fine defender. It's just there are so many unbelievable ones around him that he, compared to those guys, doesn't look on the same level. Then it's like, okay, you still got the two Williamses and Robert and Grant. You still got Horford. That's your big man rotation. You're fine.
You don't have Ennis Freedom anymore.
Yeah. It's just that was the weak link. That was the weak link.
All right. I'm going to pivot here because I don't want to look backward too much. The series is over. Boston's badass. They're on their way. Before we get into the other series, I want to get your guys' thoughts on where the Nets are going. Like a lot of people, I'm not alone here. Listen, Kyrie, he's just too much. Like, he's just too much. You know, the way he's handling his media, I'm really getting, and I don't know, I should probably man up and write this, because it's not just Kyrie. I'm so sick and tired of stars not being accountable. And that's way too simplistic of a way of saying it. I just want some authenticity with their perspective, which is to say, Kyrie needs to stop saying that he couldn't play in the regular season. There is a massive distinction and difference between couldn't and wouldn't. And I respect his choice as a human. That's a different conversation. But the fact that he continues, when he reflects on the way this regular season went, to describe his choice not to get the vaccine as a couldn't, as if it wasn't available, as if that was not an option, is disingenuous. And the quote that is going to live in infamy going forward after game 3 reads as such: That team and that other locker room is gelling at the right time. They've been gelling since Christmas. I don't want to be too cliche, but I don't have a lot of answers for how you make up time from October until now, when usually teams would be gelling and things would be feeling good. You could put it on me in terms of playing better, controlling the game better, controlling our possessions, being in more of a stance, not turning the ball over as much. And then again, he went on to say that he couldn't play. It's driving me nuts. I mean, and to me, this Nets season, it's obviously just comes down to that. There was a lot to it. You can kill James Harden for forcing his way out to Philly. I'm actually not that mad at him. Like, you know, you look around and you're down a star who was part of the plan because he won't get the shot. That's a program change that I think opens up doors like the one to Philadelphia. Kevin Durant tried his damn best. That guy balled out. He's coming off, you know, terrible Achilles injury. Was amazing in the playoffs last year. I got nothing to say about Kevin. But then, you know, after game four, Kyrie just, again, there's not much humility. You just got embarrassed by the team that you said goodbye to a couple of years ago. And you immediately announced that not only are you going to resign, but you plan on managing the team alongside Joe Tsai, the owner, and Sean Marks, the GM.
Didn't mention Steve Nash. I know Kevin Durant was like very much backing Steve Nash. I thought it was interesting from a guy who, by the way, remember a quote a couple of years ago when he was like, "We don't really need a head coach. I could be the head coach."
That was coming Kevin in this season. That wasn't a couple of years ago, wasn't it? Oh, you're right. No, that was going into Nash's first year. I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean that's a whole nother part of the conversation too. So let's the future of the Nets. That was my little rant. But Steve Nash,
also, by the way, on the other side of his argument, Sam. Sorry, it's the Celtics massively changed their roster midseason. So that part of the point doesn't even hold up. Like they traded for Derek White. They traded Schroeder. Like they made major changes. They got Tice.
You just sat there and watched the, I mean, I don't want to pretend that I was not close enough to the Boston situation to have an acute understanding of the personal dynamics. I think I have a decent one, which is to say that Tatum and Brown will continue to not disparage Kyrie, and they will continue to be, you know, good with him off the court seemingly. But the whole idea from anybody you talked to about that situation was that the universe did not revolve enough around Kyrie. And when he got hurt and they flourished without him, that changed the way he felt about the situation. So he went from telling Celtics fans, "I'm back, I'm coming, I'm going to be with you forever," essentially, to saying, "I'm out." And then
I thought you were going to say to double birding them as an opponent.
Yeah, that too. And, you know, and so now you just saw these youngsters who, again, the perception was that they weren't, you know, you were so much better than them that, you know, you had to change your franchise again because, you know, they weren't honoring that. And they just bounced you out of the first round. And now the whole vibe continues that, you know, the Nets are just so incredibly lucky to have me and I'm going to run the entire franchise.
So, what I agree with this quote that with the one you read, which is, you know, Boston really needed time to gel. Remember, they were like through what, January, they were a play-in team, really bad. Yeah. One of the big disappointments in the league. You know, Ime Udoka is like challenging them in post game. You know, that was such a like.
He was afraid. As a quick context thing, Slater, Jason Quick had a great piece on Ime recently. And man, you talk about an anecdote. I think it was Damon Stoudemire, Celtics assistant, sharing that he's like, he might not talk about it, but early in the season, he didn't even want to like walk around Boston because the fans thought he couldn't coach. You know, so yeah, they got off to a bad start.
Yeah, so, but that in retrospect, clearly, and you've read stuff coming out of there and just, you know, common sense is that was such an important time for them to challenge each other, you know, figure out flaws, figure out who they did and didn't want on the roster, you know, learn the team together. And they came out of it as this monster. Whereas I agree with Kyrie, because the Nets got basically 0 minutes together, like as what they thought they were going to be, still haven't really, you know, with Ben Simmons playing 0 minutes and Joe Harris, obviously, like that is why they were not good this season. And Kyrie obviously leaves out the fuller context of his role in that, which is the most massive role of anybody. But
I think he had, tell me if you guys disagree, I think he had a different vision. I think he literally thought he was going to game the system, come back so fresh because he had clocked in half the time, and he was going to dominate, and they were going to find a way to make this thing happen. You know, I don't think he went into the playoffs going, "Oh boy, we haven't had time to gel."
Well, I want to say another thing about Kyrie. I mean, I'm watching it last night, like in some ways kind of wanted the series to extend because it's been pretty good theater. And so I don't want to say I'm rooting for the Nets late, but you know, you just kind of like the team that's down, they're fighting for their season. Yeah. You naturally are like, you know, watching through their lens, like fight for this, you know, to keep it alive. And it's like 13 seconds left. I think KD misses a free throw. They're down two. They come down to the other end, and I can't remember who missed the layup. Might have been Smart. Kyrie there and Al Horford. Obviously, Al Horford has the physical advantage, but Kyrie is 13 seconds left in the season, down to watching Al Horford just come in and get an offensive rebound, put back to end their season, essentially. No physicality at all. And that was just like a common theme. Like, to me, game one, he was obviously an unbelievable shot maker, which he is. You can, you know, ISO clip some of his makes in this series or his dribble moves and be like, you know, top 25 player ever, right? There's guys in the league that would argue most skilled point guard in history. This is the most skilled duo ever. He's not playing good winning basketball. Marcus Smart was a far better player in that series than Kyrie Irving was, because Marcus Smart is defending, rebounding, you know, diving for loose balls, passing, just playing playoff basketball. And to me, Kyrie Irving was making some nice individual moves at times and doing very little else to win games. So to me, it's beyond you weren't able to gel in December, January, February. Yes, I was a part of it. Like, just didn't play very good at all, fresh or not. Like, there's just no physicality to the Nets game. And that goes beyond him. I mean, Kevin was obviously Blake Griffin, getting beat
that's
up.
About it.
Seth Curry, yeah. Like, you know, Patty Mills, Goran Dragic. There's no beef on that roster, no muscle.
Well, Kyrie, I mean, his value, like you said, it's as a shot maker. Game two, 4 for 13. Game three, 6 for 17. And game four, 6 for 13. He had 20 points. He really struggled in the first half just being able to find shots.
Right, how with the turnover situation?
2-2-2 in each game. But the crazy greater context of that is not the individual lines. It's the fact that the Celtics' entire game plan was they were just going to load up on KD. They were going to bump him. They were going to bruise him. They were going to send defenders at him. They were going to double him. They were going to cut off the head of the snake, and they deemed that to be Kevin Durant. And Kyrie had a lot of opportunities to go one-on-one. Now, a lot of those opportunities were up against Marcus Smart. But if you're a guy who is good enough to deem himself co-ownership of the organization, you've got to be able to get good looks up in a situation like that where the guy you're playing with is just getting swarmed. Because number one, your number one value is a shot maker. And number two, it might give somebody a little bit of a second look if you do that for an entire series. So, or a second thought if you do that for an entire series. Now, all of a sudden, maybe they can't guard Kevin Durant that way. I don't think the Celtics ever had any second thoughts about the ways that they played defensively, because, man, it looked unbelievable. It worked fantastically. And Kyrie kind of never gave them a reason other than a good performance in game one to really think otherwise. And, that's on him. He almost looked tired in those moments. I don't know what it was, but he just did not perform like all NBA caliber Kyrie Irving.
Agreed. And we'll see what happens. I mean, there's folks in the league wonder, you know, Steve Nash, from the second he took the Nets job, folks who knew Steve were a little surprised. Like, man, he just went from playing volleyball in Manhattan Beach and living the life to, you know, a job that, to his defense, these 2 years with COVID and everything, it's been nonstop chaos from a lot of different directions. So, you know, some rumblings of kind of curiosities about where Steve's future lies. I think he's got a seat if he wants it. We'll see there. But I don't know. I also think before we pivot, is it too general to make this point about some of these guys? I thought about this last night, the topic of hunger and desire and the players who seem pretty desperate to win a championship and the ones who seem very content to just compete at a certain level, not, you know, with every ounce of their being, but they're competing. I feel like it's kind of plain as day in these playoffs that the guys that, you know, that are on each side of that fence. And you think about Chris Paul, who at this late age still obviously looks desperate. He's never won one. He's got, you know, a lot on the line in terms of his legacy. You know, I know that you can't cut, that thread doesn't go through everybody, if that makes sense. But it, some of these guys just seem like they're rolling the ball out, and some seem like, you know, they're not going to be able to live if they don't win this thing.
I don't think that's like a, just a modern trend. I mean, that's the NBA history, right? You know, champions, like, people separate themselves in the playoffs. Do you see the Draymond quote?
Okay,
the other
but
day?
Let's talk from a life standpoint. I hear you, but if you literally go back only 10, 12 years, the money is like, you know, 20% of what it is now.
Still, that's probably, I mean, you can go back in history and find a whole bunch of guys that just like didn't love the game like some of the other guys love the game, didn't want to work like, you know, some of the greats of that era. The problem is, you know, when we think about past eras, we only think about the title teams. We don't think about the 8 seed that year that got eliminated, because like, why would we talk about that team that had that player that didn't care? I generally know kind of what you're saying, but I just like,
well,
Draymond
I'm
had
still
the quote
probably
the other
on
day,
that
like, some guys who we think are guys are not guys on this stage, and
right. That
is what makes the guys so fun to watch.
Some of those guys have been that guy. Kyrie's been that guy. He's hit one of the biggest shots in finals history. He's got a ring. He earned it. You know what I mean? And then now it feels like he's going to do his thing, you know, and even, I mean, the Ben Simmons situation. I mean, the idea that they were putting out there for days that Ben was coming back, and then Ben, you know, Ben can't play. I mean, that entire team other than Kevin is the, you got to convince them to show up to work squad.
Well, I'll tell you what, Sam, if you're worried about desire, you can always watch that Jose Alvarado Chris Paul matchup. That fourth quarter of game four of Jose Alvarado forcing an 8-second violation on Chris Paul, and then getting him with his hiding in the corner, I'm going to sneak behind you and poke the ball away. Chris Paul getting so angry, Jose Alvarado getting so pumped. This has nothing to do with taking joy in Chris Paul. I respect the hell out of Chris Paul. I just love seeing a guy match Chris Paul's intensity. Like, we never see that.
Yes.
Chris Paul is always the more intense one. And to
see, he's about to be in game five.
To see an undrafted rookie match Chris Paul's intensity. Mike, that quarter was so fun watching Herb Jones block 3 3-pointers. And you want a fun team that cares like crazy, a fun series that cares like crazy?
All right, you want to go Pelicans? We doing
Pelicans? Yeah, that series is so fun.
Let's do it. I mean, I'm with you. First of all, Fred, shout out to you, because all season long, you've been on the Herb Jones kick and telling people if they're not watching, they need to watch. That dude is so much fun to watch. His defense is all world, 35th overall pick. I don't know how he slips to the second round. He was SEC Defensive Player of the Year, SEC Player of the Year. And you mentioned Chris Paul. I mean, listen, Chris, we know, has had his you know, innumerable bouts with, you know, quote unquote borderline dirtiness. And I mean, Chris's hit on Herb Jones in the fourth quarter was nasty. And I actually think he probably should have been ejected. He wound up, he nailed him in the head. He was not anywhere close to the ball, not anywhere close. He stays in the game. Herb, I was already loving his vibe, his game, his competitiveness. And then the moment that I wrote about last night in a playoff notebook is, you know, is Chris coming over to help Herb off the floor, seemingly having kind of the demeanor of like, I'm going to acknowledge that was a little rough and I'm now going to show some kindness and help you off the floor. Herb's not having his hand, waits for CJ McCollum to come by and just gives a stiff arm basically to one of the best players of all time. So the Herb stuff, Brandon Ingram playing his ass off, Alvarado, you know, kind of getting under CP's skin. There's a lot there. Do we think though that these Pels, is this the end of the fun part of the series, or is Phoenix actually in trouble?
I think Phoenix is a different team without Devin Booker. And I'll tell you what, it's really fun to focus on all the intensity stuff that I brought up, and Herb Jones's defense is outrageous. But Brandon Ingram, that dude has blossomed. He is, as Draymond would say, I think Draymond would agree with me, he's a guy, and he's a guy in the playoffs.
16-game player.
He's just become an absolutely excellent player. And, you know, his passing is unbelievable. There was a play in
Sam,
game
I gotta
four.
Tell you, this is like the ninth time this season Fred has mentioned Brandon Ingram's passing. He loves Brandon Ingram's passing.
I do. It's just an underrated part of his game. There was a play in game four where he got two guys at once with a ball fake and found Valanciunas down low between, like, passing it through the needle. He has just become this unbelievably complete offensive player. He is leading that offense right now against a superb defense. You know, you lose Devin Booker. Phoenix is still one of the best defensive teams in the entire league and played very well without Booker this year. And you know, that team is good. And I think it's possible Willie Green might be a pretty good coach too.
Yeah.
As an aside, it's just not
out great too. I mean, that really kind of jolted them late in the season.
Yeah. 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 Sorry. I was going to say that the basketball guys, like, you can't, Devin Booker just fist bumped a baby, and it was like the cutest thing you've ever seen. How do you go from that to a hamstring injury? There's something wrong with that. So, but to your point, Fred, the Suns, they have been winning all year without key players. So I'm not taking anything away. I mean, of course, if Devin's in there, do I think that the Suns are on their way? Yeah, probably. But they're still a damn good team and one that was winning at a high rate when Devin wasn't on the floor, when Chris wasn't on the floor, when Cam Johnson wasn't on the floor, Cam Payne. Bridges, of course, never misses games, but there is a lot there. But Willie Green coaching his ass off, you know, his mentor Monty Williams on the other side, seeing those guys get so fired up and then always coming so close to maybe saying a bad word is one of my favorite things in the NBA playoffs, because they are all G-rated all the time, both of them. But big picture, you also have the fact that, you know, we talked about Boston earlier and the turnaround, right? And this one is not on the same level, but it's no less significant in terms of the whiplash effect, if you will. This team was 3-16. This team was starting to get some of the tougher media coverage in the entire league. And to be honest, even national folks like myself going, all right, it's time to dig in on the New Orleans situation. Things were messy with Dave Griffin, the head of their front office. You had JJ Redick taking shots, you know, from the outside, from his experience with the Pelicans, things of that nature. The Zion Williams thing was ugly, still is not great, and we don't have clarity there. But they have a lot of pieces here, and only Zion and his family know it, to what degree they care about the picture that's being painted in New Orleans, of, you know, one that is a lot more promising than we thought it was a few months ago. But in terms of this franchise putting on its best face to try to turn something into the Zion Williamson era, they can't do much better than they're doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we mentioned Phoenix not having Devin Booker. Like, Pelicans don't have their best player.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, because it's like that situation still is like somewhat of a disaster for them. You know, the number one overall pick, who we have no idea on his future. But because David Griffin jolted them with the McCollum trade, even the Valanciunas trade from the summer for Adams has turned out well. The two finds that we mentioned, you know, Herb Jones and Alvarado in the draft, it has put the potential to shake up the West. I mean, I would pick Phoenix to win two out of the next three at least. But what if they don't? What does the West look like if the Pelicans
at least they're going to somehow win more than two out of three? Sorry, couldn't resist.
They could win two out of two, Samuel Amen.
Fair. Smart ass, Sam. Apologies. I agree. I mean, the Zion thing, we get into that real quick. You know, our Pelicans beat writer, Will Guillory, had a good piece just yesterday about the Zion situation. And it was helpful for me because it clarified the fact that I think we sometimes are assuming, oh, Zion doesn't want to play. And listen, I don't want to pretend I have clarity on this front. I don't. But, you know, Reggie Miller on the national telecast recently for TNT, you know, when he saw the viral video clip of Zion, I think, dunking through the legs at practice or in a gym, you know, was pretty adamant about this idea that if you can do that, you can give me 15 minutes a game. And so I am one of those people that when it comes to commentary, like a Hall of Famer like Reggie, he's been there, he's done that. That carries a lot of weight, but the framing of it was certainly Zion doesn't want to play. And then I read Will's piece, and there's some nuance and gray area there where he outlined the fact that the Pelicans, you know, concern here is playing a big part as well in terms of the news and Will's perspective. And he's on the ground with the team all the time. You know, he definitely doesn't anticipate Zion playing in this series. And in terms of his educated opinion, said he wouldn't rule it out if they somehow got past Phoenix. So yeah, that thing is still around the team, but the vibe, you know, around him is certainly a hell of a lot better than it was. When we are back, we're going to dive into Jazz Mavericks, gentlemen. I do have a few thoughts on the Jazz and the Mavs as well. We'll do that on the other side.
I'm Trey Wingo. And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin. What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23. For a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
All right, guys, making the rounds here. Jazz Mavericks, Game 5. You know, Utah shows all this fight in Game 4. Rudy Gobert says that we were the team we wanted to be. Good piece by our Tony Jones on that game that had me believing again. I've written a decent amount about the Jazz recently, and it's just, you know, it's like the old Godfather line. Every time, you know, you think you're out, they pull you back in terms of like thinking they can be something here. And I think I'm officially out after Game 5. The lack of spirit and out on just the idea that there's some sort of miracle turnaround here. This group has got an identity crisis. Donovan Mitchell is playing pretty bad basketball. And if I was Ryan Smith, the second year Jazz owner, that would be pretty concerning to me because I am going to assume they lose this series. I just don't see it. I know they're in Utah for Game 6. We'll see. But their entire offseason that we've talked about before, all the uncertainty, you know, barring a real surprise at the end here, my expectation is that every move they make is going to be with Donovan Mitchell at the center of their universe. Whether that means Rudy Gobert gets traded, if Quinn Snyder walks, whatever might happen, Donovan, in terms of their internal calculus, is the one thing they're not questioning. So it's pretty bad timing to have him look like somebody who doesn't necessarily, isn't playing like somebody who might deserve that kind of cachet. He's a big part of the problem right now.
You know what adds to the concern to me? That one time he's looked lively this series and productive was when they went small and got Gobert off the floor. I can't remember what game that was, but I think it was 3. You know, they went Pascal, who, by the way, is like Eric Pascal is like one of his childhood friends. They put him at the center. They went small, and suddenly Donovan's zooming around, and they're coming back. And you know, he did have the moment, the lob to Gobert to save Game 4 and pull Sam Amick back on the boat for a 48-hour period for some reason, Sam. I don't know why you jumped back on the bandwagon briefly. But
the second I stepped in the boat, there was a hole in the hole.
Yes. But that's, to me, I mean, again, I'm not on the ground there. So Sam certainly knows more than me on like the internal dynamics and being around there.
I'm in my feelings today.
It just doesn't seem like you got to choose Donovan Mitchell or Rudy Gobert this summer. I mean, that's the big thing. Because I just don't see them together.
I don't see Donovan. He's got, I believe, 3 years left on his deal. Let me confirm this. My thing with Donovan and folks around the league.
He's got two. Not including after this year, he's got 4 years, including a player option.
Right. So three guaranteed, you know, it's all up to him, but three plus one. Mm-hmm. People, first of all, I somehow missed this. I don't know how in the hell I missed this, Fred. This is your fault because it's the team you cover normally. But World Wide West showing up to a Jazz Mavericks playoff game, you know, Knicks front office member, World Wide West, I believe with Julius Randle courtside.
That's right.
This was big news in New York. Somebody kind of laughed at me yesterday that I didn't notice this. That was something, but there's also this sense, and by the way, something that I wouldn't be shocked that the NBA is looking into because they don't like the optics of that. But that was something where the takeaway is, all right, great, but Donovan Mitchell is not James Harden in terms of personality. Donovan Mitchell, I don't get the sense that even with what's happening right now, that this offseason, that his level of discontent is going to be anywhere near the type of level it would need to be for him to find his way out of Utah. It would take, you know, an ugly kind of put your foot down, tell the world that you're just out on the Jazz type of style, the type that we've seen from James Harden and people like that before. I don't get the sense he's anywhere close to that.
Then is it Gobert or are they both back? Can you really?
No, I think it's probably Gobert. I mean, I think it's probably Gobert. And so then it's tough to analyze because you don't know what you're going to get back. I mean, you know, you put Rudy on most teams in the league, you're going to jump 10 spots in defensive rating. So he's got value. He's got a tremendous value.
I think there are teams that, I mean, he's a more specific fit than Mitchell, but I think there are a lot of teams that would, like, I just, off the top of my, these are not, I'm not reporting these teams are specifically interested, but just like places where he totally makes sense. Like, why wouldn't Dallas just go crazy for him? Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't Atlanta potentially just go crazy for him? And like, I don't know, Charlotte always wants to just, Charlotte is a make the playoffs team, right? Like, why would Charlotte not be like, you know what? Here's the guy. We're going to get him. We have a crazy offense. We have no defense. We have no defense because we have no rim protection. Let's get literally the best one out there. He can run pick and rolls to death.
And then hire with, Quinn Snyder. Is that the plan?
LaMelo. Sure. Hire Quinn Snyder. Like that's a team that makes sense. And there are various more where I'm like, okay, like, you know, maybe Portland would want to get in on the mix with Nurkic hitting free agency. Like there are a lot of teams that would be like, we'll take a guy who will boost our defense. Like if you have Rudy Gobert, you will be good at defense when he's playing.
This is such a testament.
At least
though,
in the regular season. Maybe not the playoffs, but there are plenty of teams who would just love to get in. The Charlotte Hornets haven't been in the playoffs.
Yeah, look,
that's why
like the Hornets, there's some teams, not every single team is in pursuit of a title at the same level as other teams. The Hornets, look, I covered the Wizards for years. The Wizards want to make the playoffs. That is it. The Wizards want to make the playoffs. I don't know. Maybe they would end. They just got Porzingis, but maybe they would be a team.
The thing with the Jazz, to your point, Fred, is they obviously long since reached that point of title expectations or contention. They were in that group that you know, whether it had four or five teams in it, maybe, but they were in that group. And so what does kind of drive me crazy is that the last couple of years, they more often than not, they had something go wrong at the wrong time. And it was always the, you know, what if, woulda, coulda, shoulda type takeaway to their, you know, falling short in the postseason. Mike Conley might be hurt. Bojan Bogdanovic might be hurt. You know, things like that. Donovan Mitchell has been hurt in the playoffs past. This time, this is their squad. This is their squad. This is the one that Dennis Lindsay built in the front office, now with Danny Ainge at the top of that with Justin Zanuck. But this is their squad. And those players and those people with Quinn and his staff, you know, I am very surprised that they haven't found a way to look around and say, okay, these breaks we didn't get in the past, we got them this time. But, you know, what we are seeing, I think, in pretty humbling fashion for them is that their spirit collectively is just not there. And, you know, whether you call it You know, on the defensive side, just five guys on a string and the kind of connective tissue that it takes to compete this time of year, it's not there. And it, you know, it comes in waves and they win a game like game four. But by and large, they've been extremely unimpressive for quite some time. Unless you guys have more thoughts here. We should talk Luka a little bit. Luka's killing it. I wrote today about how, you know, he's on the verge of winning his first playoff series. Which, you know, it's just been a funny dynamic the last couple of years because his numbers individually were off the charts in the postseason. But, you know, he had not gotten out of the first round just yet. He was never part of the quote unquote problem, but, you know, a guy that great. I'm just looking forward to seeing him in a deeper playoff run because, you know, he's obviously spectacular.
A week ago, I thought Dallas was dead, right? You know, you have Luka who had a scary looking calf injury and they lost game one. And, you know, Luka still wasn't doing on-court activity. You kind of thought the Jazz might, you know, take game two and just survive that first round series because, you know, you're going against a team without its best player. Luka's back now. And even in his absence, right, Jalen Brunson has elevated his status. And they just look like a firmer, very well-coached team by Jason Kidd. And while this is going on and, you know, they get him back in the mix and they're probably going to close out Utah in the next two games, we mentioned this Suns-Pelicans series and Devin Booker's unknown status and at least 2 to 3 weeks for him. They could very legitimately be a West finalist at this point. You almost might favor them at this point to come out of that side of the West bracket, you know, that pocket to make the West finals. And Sam, you kind of set the stage, but now that he's about maybe going to advance from his first playoff series, like he has the chance to take that
There's no maybe
bigger
he's
leap.
Advancing.
What up?
I said there's no maybe. He's advancing.
Wow. Sam, look at this. He thinks Utah's the NBA favorites after they win game four at home, and now he won't even look at them in the face.
Come at me, Jazz fans. When your team wins in game seven, we'll see. No, I hear you. I mean, and I'm trying to remind myself looking at the bracket here. I mean, it's you know, if they get to the next round, it'll be fun, and I still think Phoenix wins that series. But Luka in general, man, he's – that dude is just a beast. I mean, that third quarter, that three he had in the third, I think they went up 28, and he gives Steph Curry a shimmy shake. Yeah.
Does Dallas win that series if Devin Booker's not in it?
No, I still don't think so. I don't like the matchup for the Mavs. What do you guys think of that? We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but matchup-wise, I feel like the small Mavs style, I mean, it's Clippers-esque in terms of why it's causing fits for the Jazz, and it's
been cause fits for Ayton and JaVale McGee and just Phoenix without Devin Booker.
Yeah, I think on the other side though, Phoenix might be able to. I mean, I think Ayton, that could be a really good Ayton series.
The Jazz and Fred, you've said this before. We just gloss over how terrible the vast majority of Jazz defenders are outside of Rudy Gobert.
It is wild.
And that's
just
not the case in Phoenix.
They just can't stay in front of anybody, and Phoenix plays such good team defense. That's true. Those guards are going to have to fight so much harder. Like Jalen Brunson will actually have to fight so much harder to get to the paint. It's crazy. By the way, can I do a shout out while we're talking about the Mavs? We talked about Donovan Mitchell's struggles during these playoffs.
Yeah.
Shout out Dorian Finney-Smith, underrated defender.
Sure.
He has become like one of the best 3-and-D guys in the league. Like he could not shoot when he first came into the league. Now he's automatic from the corners. He's a really good 3-point shooter. And he's really taken on Donovan Mitchell and just been unbelievably physical in this series. It's not like Donovan Mitchell, you know, for every single year, I feel like we talk about how the Jazz underperformed in the playoffs. It's not really ever Donovan Mitchell's fault. Like you look at Donovan Mitchell's postseason numbers and they're ridiculous. He had that series against the Nuggets when they let go of that 3-1 lead against the Nuggets in the first round in the bubble. And, you know, it left a bad taste in everybody's mouth because they let go of a 3-1 lead in the first round. But he averaged 36 a game in that series. Like it wasn't Donovan Mitchell's fault.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's had some incredible postseasons. He's shooting under 20% from three in this series right now. And just as, it's
I think
just,
37
it's just,
overall.
Yeah, it's just difficult for him to get off comfortable shots. And I think Dorian Finney-Smith has spent a lot of time on him, and he's done a great job. He's a really, really good defender.
I'm with you mostly. I will say that the trend on the Donovan side, it's, you know, Dorian might be benefiting a tiny bit from, like, I don't know what I'm watching here with Donovan and these struggles, because the second half of the year, and Tony Jones wrote this recently, I mean, shooting 30% in the fourth quarter for the entire second half of the regular season, you know. And then you got the defensive side. Andy Larson of the Salt Lake Tribune had a really good piece the other day looking at Donovan's defense and kind of pointedly criticizing the fact that Donovan has kind of, you know, kind of cast aside questions about his defense. And Andy had a line about how, you know, he's acting as if we can't watch the film, that his defense has just been really bad. So, yeah. All right. We've done enough Jazz slander, but the Mavs look good. Jason Kidd is coaching his tail off, and all these former Lakers folks having fun in the postseason while LeBron James tweets about how he's never going to miss the playoffs again. So there's always a 6 degrees of Lakers component. All right, gentlemen, on the other side of this ad break, we are going to talk about Fred's series, the Grizzlies and Timberwolves. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
All right, guys, last one I think that we're going to dive into. I don't think we're going to do too much unless you have thoughts on Philly and Raptors, and I forget who
else. I got one Warriors thought, but that can come after Fred.
Yeah, well, I'm leaving your team out. Sorry, brother. Warriors Nuggets, but let's get into Fred's series. Fred is the newest playoff beat writer of your Memphis Grizzlies, doing good stuff on that side of the ledger, now part of the Western Conference. And this series is also fun as hell, but it's doesn't have any of the stuff that causes me angst, like we talked about earlier, the Nets vibes where folks aren't competing and acting as if everything's on the line. These two teams are young, hungry, passionate, you know, swagger for days. So much fun, so much talent. How are you feeling about all this, Fred?
It's been a really fun series. It's been a super fun series. I think the most eye-popping part of it, just from an analysis standpoint, is that especially last game, Ja Morant didn't quite look like Ja Morant. And if you ask Ja, and somebody did, he'll say the same thing. He said right after that game, I mean, quote, "I'm not Ja right now." Dropping a third person in front of everybody to hear. And you can tell. I mean, he talked about not playing above the rim. And he just, until the last couple of minutes of game four, he really wasn't attacking the rim in that, you know, patented Ja Morant sort of aggressive way. And that is so important for their offense. The other part of it is just the unbelievable amount of fouls, but Taylor Jenkins picked up a fine for calling the performance from the referees arrogant.
Yes.
Which I was
multiple times, really, right?
Multiple times he said,
Fred,
he said,
shout out to you. I actually meant to text you this. I appreciated, because you're a good reporter, the context you provided in your piece about who the referees were and their level of experience. I don't know why I must be tired. I'm blanking on who they were. Remind me, because you wrote about how you had a lot of long tenured, you know, NBA Finals regulars referees in this game.
Yeah, it was Goble. It was Bill Kennedy. And it was the third one is eluding me now. Trey Maddox.
There you go.
Was the other one. Yeah. And, you know, Bill Kennedy has been around forever. He's been doing NBA games since the 90s, I think.
Yeah. John and Bill in particular are extremely high rated refs.
Yeah. Extremely high rated refs. I just thought it was so interesting to hear arrogant. It's so much more personal when you say arrogant. I was actually surprised the fine was only 15. My guess is the fine was only 15 was because the league office went through it and realized, oh, these were some bad calls. There was a period in game four where Desmond Bain got called for an offensive foul, which would have been his fourth foul and it was the third quarter. The next play, D'Angelo Russell got a ticky-tack offensive foul, which was one of those that kind of felt like a makeup call for the previous call. And then the next play, Desmond Bane got another offensive foul. The first one had been reversed on a challenge. The next play, Desmond Bane got another offensive foul, essentially in the exact same way, and did not look like an offensive foul. So, and that one might have been a makeup for the D'Angelo Russell one. So it was like, it was there were just so many guys going to the line. There were so many guys in foul trouble. It's kind of colored the series in some ways. I don't think it's as anti-Memphis as Taylor Jenkins was bringing it up to be after that game four performance. But it's always interesting to see how referees come back after those sorts of comments from players and coaches and all of that, you know?
Well, and now you got me thinking a little bit on the officiating side before we go to Warriors Nuggets. Remind me, unless I missed it, guys, did the league not hit Monty Williams with a fine?
Yeah, he got fined.
He did get it. Okay.
Gobert got fined for cussing.
Well, the Monty one I was watching because I appreciated Monty's, I don't know if it was an attempt to not get fined, but he framed his criticism in a way where he said, you know, that he didn't think it was, I'm paraphrasing, fair that, you know, when I think their game was 42-15 in free throws, and would feel like, you know, coaches feel like they are going to get their heads cut off if they highlight that kind of discrepancy. So I felt like, you know, he did his best to you know, try to wiggle around the fine. Obviously didn't. As a general quick commentary thing, I don't know. I kind of wish that the league would chill on the idea that that coaches and players are not allowed to talk about the refs. I mean, the league is featuring the officials more than ever. They have, you know, all access referee segments on NBA TV with kind of human interest stories of individual referees. And I like it. I think it's better for the fans to know some of the people making these calls. But then on the back end, it's just like, no. Don't ever talk about the impact that their calls have. And they just run around slapping everybody on the wrist.
I generally agree with you. I just think they're afraid of, like, you know, and I see it every time. We all do, with, like, particularly the fan bases we're most around. Like, if the team loses a playoff game, it's like conspiracy theories run wild, right? You know, oh, yeah. Like, this was because the league wanted this result. So, and then I just think when the major figures kind of throw logs on the fire by intimating that it was like a really poorly ref game, it just kind of just spins that cycle too much and gets it away from the court product more than like conspiracy theories. But I know what you're saying, Sam.
I just hate it. My thing that I really don't like is when people use foul shot discrepancy as proof of an unfairly refereed game, as if if basketball is officiated perfectly, then everybody gets the same amount of free throws, that how much you foul is only how much it's called, not how much you are actually committing fouls. It reminds me of when our esteemed president said that if we test less for COVID, then we'll just have less COVID. It's like that. It's,
don't be putting foul shots. Biden. You got to at least say which president you're talking about.
I think people can guess, but you know, Fred's trying to take us down a controversial path.
The point of free throws is that you're fouling too much. The Grizzlies, by the way, foul a lot. Jaren Jackson Jr. fouls a lot. A lot of those fouls, not all of them, it was not a well-officiated game. I just, in general, am not for using free throw discrepancy.
I agree, but isn't there a threshold when it's nearly triple? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's a threshold. Because as a general rule, yes, like, that's not proof of a badly officiated game. This one, though, Monty's more nuanced point was that the Suns were in attack mode. The Suns were in the paint. The Suns were doing similar types of things to what Memphis was doing, and the whistle didn't come their way. And we don't need to litigate how the game was called. I find the politics around referee criticism a little troubling. All right, Slater, Fred had to jump. Appreciate him as always. Real quick on the back end here, Warriors Nuggets game five coming up on Wednesday night.
Yeah,
we didn't think we would be here. The Nuggets show some life, even with Draymond Green sticking his finger in Nikola Jokic's eye, things of that nature. Denver lives to fight another day. What do you think there?
Yeah, you know, it was, you could tell Denver really didn't want to get swept. Even Malone was pretty transparent about it post game. I don't suddenly think this is going to turn into Raptors Sixers and it's going back to Denver and there's real drama about, you know, if the Warriors are advancing. We'll see. They could steal a game, but, you know, a lot of the advantages still obviously tilt the Warriors' direction. But I wrote about Klay Thompson today. I just kind of, you know, there's been, you know, Jalen Brunson, Jordan Poole, Tyrese Maxey. This has been a playoffs of emerging stars, and I do think under the radar a little bit is Klay Thompson. Looks kind of like himself. His last seven games, he's averaging 30 points, 29.7. He's shooting 50% from three, 53% overall. He leads the NBA right now in the playoffs with 21 made threes, four dribbles for 32 points the other day. Like, this is him again offensively. It's not him defensively quite the same, but
yeah, this Bones is the Highland catch. Ate him up on that one position.
Yeah, Bones. So this is that's defensively, he is not as laterally quick and never will be again. He's 32 coming off the injuries, but they're playing him more at the three in this small lineup, which he is now a three to me more than a two. He's always been like a big two. Now he's just kind of got to be a three, which is okay.
Well, isn't that convenient? Because they stumbled their way into another two.
Yeah. Yes, they did. And, you know, it's good you mentioned that because early in Klay Thompson's return, he was dribbling a ton, and I put a bunch of stats in the. I did like, yeah, kind of a deep dive into the Klay story. He was trying to take guys off the dribble, pick and roll operating, and you look at all the numbers. Like, he was taking a bunch more shots than he ever has, like after three or four or five dribbles, which isn't him. But then Jordan Poole has arisen basically, and that has allowed him to settle back into the proper role for him, which is like pure catch and shoot guy. And, you know, get it on his hands and it's gone. And that's how he has games like game four, where it's four dribbles, 32 points. And he's just, he just looks like himself. He's bouncing around out there. He's curling off screens. He's catching the ball with 21 on the clock in transition and firing up a 28 footer. And the defense is freaking out and he's hitting it. And I just, as we, assuming the Warriors move past the Nuggets, which I think we both believe they will. I mean, I just think a lot of the check marks that we were, the unknowns that we thought about this Warriors team going into the playoffs, which would be, how does Steph Curry look? The answer is pretty healthy. He looks pretty healthy. Would Draymond Green hold up physically? He's looked good, you know, in a bunch of center minutes against Jokic. What about Jordan Poole on this playoff stage? How will he perform? Very well. And even Klay Thompson, it's like, can he get somewhere near his form? I mean, he's the hottest shooting 3-point guy in the league right now. Like, this is, I mean, a lot of stuff is really going the Warriors' way.
Yeah. What are they going to do with the lineup, Slater? That's the only thing to me that, you know, might have a little bit of trip up potential.
Yeah. Steph Curry will be back starting. I'm pretty sure he'll be back starting game five against the Nuggets, which means somebody has to come out. We'll see. The choice seems to be between Jordan Poole goes back to a six-man role or Kevon Looney goes to the bench and they play their just like supercharged three-guard lineup right at the start. I could see the staff keeping Looney for this game because Nikola Jokic just still exists in this world. But once they advance, I think it's pretty obvious they need to make Looney the backup center and just start, you know, the small lineup, which is Poole, Curry, Klay, Wiggins, Draymond. Game one have any, of the next round.
Any sense? I don't know Jordan really at all. I haven't been around him a lot. What is his? I mean, when you succeed at this rate and you show, you know, yourself at times to be just an all-star caliber player, where is his head at when it comes to the ego aspect of this decision?
We may have to see that. I mean, that definitely has been a tiptoe behind the scenes, and in many ways. It's why I think Steph Curry has remained on the bench through four games. Steph Curry played 37 minutes last game. They weren't no longer managing some tiny minutes restriction like in game one. He could have started, and he didn't. And I don't know if you've seen his quotes. He's talked about basically, I hope I'm demonstrating that it doesn't matter if you come off the bench or not. He's not talking to Nemanja Bjelica. He's not talking to Kevon Looney, who has been benched and re-benched like 19 times in his career. He's talking to Jordan Poole. We will see. And the truth is, I mean, I know they're kind of
massaging. Shout out to Steph on that, man. I love that vibe. Like, that reminds me a little bit of, you know, Monty Williams always wears his hat that is his saying. You've probably seen it. It says WS for well said, and then it has a greater than symbol, and it's WS is better than WD, well done. I'm sorry, other way around. Well done.
Yeah, well done is better than well said.
Better than well said. To me, this is Steph. He doesn't need to put, you know, that many words on it. He doesn't need to speak on it that much, but his actions are showing for the future. And as they try to get this thing to its maximum level, that, you know, that he's willing to sacrifice as the guy who built this entire thing, you know, from the ground up.
Yeah. So I believe they're messaging well enough and demonstrating from Curry well enough behind the scenes that if Jordan Poole is told to come off the bench in game five, he should be able to. He's still going to get 30 something minutes, right? Yeah. I mean, they're going to play this lineup like crazy. Looney can start and get 12 minutes essentially. But tactically, I think moving forward beyond this series, they need to lean in. And it's not that you should start Jordan Poole because you don't want to, you know, mismanage, you know, the personality aspect. I think they should start Jordan Poole because, like, this is who they are. This is who they should be from an identity standpoint, which is you put three bombers on the floor together. Draymond tries to hold down the interior, and you just try to boat race teams with that lineup. So that's just what I think they should do.
Do you have, not to put you on the spot, the latest numbers on that lineup, whether we call it Death and Max's or
In the two Denver games, it wasn't as potent. It was about even or so. So they're probably somewhere still around like plus 29 through four games, which is still huge numbers, but it's not as outrageous. The one thing I would say, the three guard lineup, if you just, you know, filter it. So just when those three have been on the floor together this season, in regular season and playoffs, they are plus 112 in 173 minutes. Those three together just have just terrorized teams.
Right.
You know, you can have different iterations, you know, next to them. And that could be, typically you want Draymond holding down the interior, but, you know, if Otto Porter's out there, Kuminga they threw out there the other day in game four, which was interesting. But when those three are on the floor together, as Mike Malone has said many times in the series, I think he called it the three-headed monster.
It's Michael Malone.
Michael Malone.
I don't want to get you in trouble there.
My bad. That's their, particularly with Poole and Curry, that's their two best offensive players. And the way Clay's shooting, that's their three best offensive players.
All right, brother. Great stuff. We made the rounds. Sorry to Sixers and Raptors fans and Heat and Hawks. We didn't get into those two series all that much. But lots of good action, and goodbye to those Brooklyn Nets. And we'll see what the offseason holds for them. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody.